back to the Drex Radio Show.
Now back to the Drex Radio Show
on KGO 810.
Young man, there's no need to feel down. I said, young man, before you fly out of town. I say, young man, before the plane leaves the ground, there's one thing you must still do. Yeah, young man, step on out of your shoes. I said, young man,
then
check your carry-on too. I said, young man, and if there's too much shampoo, they just might pull you out of line. You're getting felt up by the TSA. You're getting felt up by the TSA.
That's one way of having fun.
They
yeah.
check everything in the back and the front, and they're probably
everybody's dancing.
You're getting felt up by the TSA. You're getting felt up by the TSA.
I think that's a lot better than the clowns and the stilt walkers they had at O'Hare. You know, I don't know what a clown does for me. Yeah. I can tell you, if I waited 3 hours in line to get a flight, I think I would demand the pat down, please. At least give me some pleasure. All right, which is a great lead into my next guest, Nagin Farsad. And Nagin, thank you very much for joining me. I do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I get the TSA intro.
Yes, you do. And since you are, now, how do you describe yourself? Islamic American, is that right?
I am an Iranian-American Muslim lady.
Oh, okay. Well, then you must know all about the TSA.
I may or may not be on some list. It's unclear.
Do they hassle you when you go through the TSA?
Well, I think that I get hassled the regular amount. I mean, I feel like in the beginning I was hassled more, and now they've streamlined me, and now recently I have TSA pre, so I don't even take my shoes off, which I feel like is what life's all about.
Well, do you wear the headdress? Because I'm curious about that, because it was just 2 weeks ago that I'm sure you heard on a Southwest flight that they some idiot came up to a woman and ripped off her hijab, right? Yeah. And said, yeah, this is America.
Right. No, I don't wear, I'm a very secular Muzz. So I'm basically, you know, as Muslim as like most of your friends are probably Christian or Jewish or something. Like, you know, they might go to church once a year or sort of never, but they still consider themselves Christian. You know, I'm like on the secular range. And one of the things I find frequently with people is that they don't actually realize that secular Muslims exist. And so that's, you know, one of my things is to be like, hey, we exist. It's cool.
I love it. And what you must know is that Nagin is, and she has her own book, Nagin Farsad. She's a comedian. And the name of her book is How to Make White People Laugh. So that's what
yeah.
you do. Yes, it's a lot of fun. And I love just from the very beginning that you, when you were younger, you identified as an African-American, because this is very interesting. I don't know how you ended up, of all places, down there. Where
Palm Springs.
Palm Springs, yes. Of all places to go to high school. It's just insane.
No, it's totally weird. Palm Springs is a super strange town. It's like one of the top five retirement communities in California, also
sure.
one of the top five like gay cities. And so it's the kind of place where you'll see people dancing to Lady Gaga while adjusting their catheters. You know what I mean? It's just, I grew up in among the senior citizens, like in my neighborhood. There were only, I was the only kid, and I would be, you know, playing in the front yard as very, very, very slow moving Cadillacs would come down the street, and that is what that was what it was like for me growing up. It is weird that we ended up there. We ended up there because my dad is a doctor, and he was we were actually in the sticks of Virginia, and he was doing his doctoring there, and a friend of his called him up and was like, you know, you have to get over here. There are so many old people, and they're all having heart attacks, and they need your, you know, doctoring services. Like, this is where it's at, you know? And so my dad, was all into treating people who got those.
And it reminded me when I read the part of your bio here that you, grew up in Palm Springs, I was thinking, wow, I wonder if she saw Bing Crosby's house where Bieber stayed during Coachella.
Oh,
you probably know where that house is.
Bing Crosby's, you know whose house was really popular to like sight because it was very visible, was Bob Hope's house.
Oh,
it
yeah,
looked
that's
like a
right.
giant
he was there too.
Mushroom kind of on the mountain. And so everyone always pointed out that house. And Elvis, I think I saw Elvis Presley's house. There's a shotgun, a bullet hole in a wall because he saw himself on TV and he didn't like what he looked like or some story like that. I don't remember.
I remember that story. I didn't know that he did that in Palm Springs, though.
That happened in Palm Springs, yeah. And so you could still see the bullet hole in the wall. Or as
great.
A kid. I mean, I don't know. I saw it as a kid. I don't know if it still exists.
And then what do you think about the fact that, and by the way, the Iranians are serious. They think that Kim Kardashian is a CIA spy. Did you hear that story? Yeah, they do. They're very
Have
serious
they
about
it. Have they seen her selfie book?
That's what's going on. And so any Iranian who has anything to do with Instagram, they're monitoring her or them or those citizens of Iran, Iran or Iran?
I say Iran. It doesn't really matter.
Right. Okay, so yeah, they think she's a spy. And so anybody who's looking at her on Instagram might be colluding with her.
I might be one of few Americans who do not follow Kim Kardashian on Instagram.
Well, good for you, yes.
So I don't think I would be, but I don't. You know, honestly, like I haven't been back to Iran in a long, you know, in many years, and I think part of that is because my family is worried that I would be on a list just because I'm like a comedian. I say things I don't, you know.
You do.
I don't censor
yes.
myself at all whatsoever. So yes.
Well, let's just talk about one that caught my attention right away. Was Iranians? Iranians have no gaydar. Yeah.
Well, so I was saying, you know, Palm Springs has a really large gay population. And so growing up, we had a lot of gay neighbors in my neighborhood, and my parents would, their number one thing was to misidentify all gay neighbors as roommates because we actually loved our neighbors. And so they didn't want to have to be like, oh, they're gay, don't talk to, like, they didn't want to have to activate their homophobia because they actually liked the neighbors. And they also didn't want to have to explain like homosexuality to me or anything like that. So they were just like, I don't know, they're neighbors, let's not talk about it. So it was a very serious don't ask, don't tell roommate policy in the Farsad residence. And so we had a lot of gay neighbors that we got along with tremendously well. They would babysit me. It was a whole thing. But my parents just, you know, steadfastly referred to them as roommates.
And probably taught you how to do the YMCA, yes.
Exactly. And famously, the former president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, which is, by the way, a name you get to say, one of the benefits of being very, one of the few benefits of being Iranian is that I can pronounce that guy's name, and I could, like, you know, fly around on a magic rug granting people wishes. But one of the things he famously said was that we don't have homosexuals in Iran. And he said, I don't know who told you that we have homosexuals. We don't have homosexuals. And so I quote him in the book because he definitely had no gaydar.
Well, but they're there. And I know they do horrible things to those who protest and come out of the closet. It's just awful. But they exist. But they, again, I think it's one of these things that they don't want to, as you said, your parents did, they don't want to say what it is. Obviously, it goes on.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, when we're talking about countries in the Middle East that have a, you know, a real problem with that kind of thing, I'd say you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia are, like, really different. Like, Saudi Arabia really has no, you know, in, women in Iran have the highest rate of degree attainment. They drive cars.
That's
they
right.
vote. They're lawyers. They're doctors. They're whatever, you know. People in Iran make movies. They make music. It's they have, there's a civil society, which I think is part of the reason why, like, it's, you know, it's an actual.
And like, they like Americans.
Worry about.
Yes.
Oh, my God. They love America. And the, you know what they can't stop doing? They can't stop getting plastic surgery. They love beautiful. I mean, they're basically, being in Iran is like basically watching an episode of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Like, these people are just, they're just like Americans, just a touch more tan. But, you know, so when we're talking about, like, real hardcore oppression, we're not really talking about Iran. In the Middle East, we're probably, you know, more likely talking about Saudi Arabia, where women have to cover every inch of their bodies,
right.
And it's a whole,
can't drive,
you know, and
they
aren't allowed
vote,
to drive,
right.
And they aren't allowed to vote, and they aren't allowed to do so many things. And so yeah.
All right, let's take a break, and we'll be back with Nagin Farsad. The name of her book is How to Make White People Laugh, and that's what she's doing, and we'll continue coming up on the Drex Radio Show on KGO.
Drex on KGO 810.
We're back, and we're having fun. We're talking about how to make white people laugh, and Nagin Farsad is my guest, and she's an Iranian, Islamic, American. You're an American. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes. And, all of those things.
All right. So, and then NaginFarsad.com is your website. Your Twitter handle is the same thing, Nagin Farsad. And we'll post everything at KGORadio.com. So, let me ask you this. How do you explain social justice comedy?
Ah, yes. Well, social justice comedy is kind of what I think is my brand of comedy. I basically, you know, it's comedy that's not political. It's, you know, it's not partisan. It's about justice, right? Social justice comedy is inviting and warm. It makes you feel like you're sitting inside of a burrito.
Right.
and, you know, and it's funny, but it's sneaky, right? Like, you could be hearing something about income inequality encased in a really sophisticated poop joke. So those are kind of the hallmarks of social justice comedy. It'll be something about justice, but it's still sneaky and funny. You know, it's not hitting you over the head. It's not lecturing you. You'll have a good time, and you'll feel delight.
Well, since you are an Iranian, Islamic American, I have to ask you about Donald Trump.
Oh.
Well, I think everybody that pretty much listens to KGO probably did the same thing right when you did. Okay. This is not KSFO, people. Yeah, this is the other side. Yeah. Well, you're allowed to go there. Yes.
Well, you know, it's funny because we spent so long just being like, oh, like all the smart people said there's no way that he's going to have the nomination, you know, and I read all the smart people say that, and I was like, well, there's just no way, you know, and I just thought, oh, he's such a clown, it's just impossible, you know, and then now we basically are at this point where the nominee of the Republican Party is a raging bigot. We've nominated a raging bigot to President of the United States, and that's crazy. That's scary. And I think that's one thing we need to constantly remember about him, is that he is a raging bigot and a raging misogynist. Like, both of those, it's like a really obscene cocktail. And he is quite possibly going to be president of the United States.
Yes, I was going to tag it with that. And there's a very good possibility he is going to be in the White House. Yes.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, you know, that I like to do comedically is sort of take his proposals at face value and take them to their logical limits. For example, you know, all the stuff that he said about Muslims and banning them and whatnot. One of the things I did, I made a video with MoveOn.org and Upworthy. We basically went to, in the streets of New York, and I would ask people, are you Muslim? And they would say, no. And I'd be like, okay, prove it. And they'd have to eat from a cold pile of bacon. I called it the bacon test. And basically, vegans wouldn't eat the bacon. I'd be like, you're Muslim. Jews were Muslim. You know, vegetarians were Muslim. Anyone who didn't eat the bacon, Muslim. And then if they didn't eat it, then they'd have to sign a Muslim registry, which looked like a bridal registry that had, like, frilly flowers and writing on it. And and so, you know, I basically did something to kind of illustrate, if we're really going to ban Muslims, we're talking about a religious test, and what is our religious test? How would that even work? P.S., it's unconstitutional. So I have a lot of fun kind of like taking Trump's actual proposals at face value and seeing if they're even remotely executable.
Well, now, I want you to tell everybody the story, because you did this in 2014 with the New York City MTA when they launched that insidious anti-Muslim campaign on the subway system, and you responded to that campaign. Tell everybody how you did that.
Yeah, this actually just came to a resolution, 6 weeks ago or something, so this is still pretty fresh. But in 2014, an anti-Muslim group spent over $300,000 on the New York City subway system, the MTA, to put up anti-Muslim posters. And needless to say, they were like horribly offensive and like not to mention really ugly, because I guess bigots don't have really good design sense. They spent a lot of money on these things. And at the time, I had a movie that had just come out called The Muslims Are Coming, where I basically rounded up a bunch of Muslim American comedians, you know, in a nonviolent way. And we went around the country to places like Alabama and Tennessee and Arizona. And
but that was fun, yes.
Yeah, because there are places that obviously love the Muzzies. And we called these shows The Muslims Are Coming, and it later turned into a movie with people like Jon Stewart and Janine Garofalo and Louis Black. And that movie is now available on all the wherever online movies are streamed. And we thought, okay, you know, why don't we put up our own poster campaign that says delightful things about Muslims and promotes the movie at the same time? And so we worked with the MTA on putting up these posters. We worked with them for over 5 months, right? And they had, like, changes for us constantly. Like, we couldn't use the word genitals. Like, we couldn't use the word poop. Like, half of our material ended up getting cut because of that. But we worked with them at every step because we really wanted to be flexible and work within their parameters. And we finally got our posters approved, but then 2 days after they were supposed to go up, the MTA banned the posters, citing political content. And if you look at the content that's on the posters, like one of them said, beware the Muslims are coming, and they have great frittata recipes. So either frittatas are really political for the MTA, or the mere mention of the word Muslims is political, but it isn't. You know, it's about justice. And so what we ended up having to do was sue the MTA. And I've never sued a major state agency before. I don't know if you have.
No, I haven't. Nor do I want to.
Well, I don't recommend it. It's rather harrowing, and it takes forever. But we finally got the judgment back, and we won. Like, we were victorious. And finally, we're able to get our posters up. And that was I realize that victory feels like what hot blonde girls feel like every day. It's kind of awesome. I totally recommend it. So those posters have been up, actually. And many of them are still up in the New York City subway system right now.
That's fantastic. So if you take a trip to the Apple, look for them. All right, we are talking with Nagin Farsad. She's an Iranian-American comedian, writer, actor, filmmaker based in New York City. And let me see, you're one of the top 10 feminist comedians to watch by Paper Magazine, and you do TED Talks, and I want to talk about some of your shows that you do, and we'll continue the conversation in just a minute on the Drex Radio Show on KGOA 10.
You're listening to the Drex Radio Show, on KGOA 10.
And as the sun goes down, broadcasting live to the entire Western United States, good evening, and thank you for joining me. Nagin Farsad is my guest. She's an Iranian-American comedian, writer, actor, and filmmaker. All of those things wrapped in one. It's a lovely frittata is what it is. It just is. Now, when you do you do stand-up? I would imagine you do.
Yeah, that's kind of how I got started with all these shenanigans.
Yeah, well, and great shenanigans they are. And so hecklers never go away from anybody. It doesn't matter whether you're black, white, or I'm going to ask you now about being Muslim and Iranian. How do you handle hecklers?
You know, it's interesting because hecklers are, like, I think that's some, like, one of the hardest lessons in being a comedian is just figuring out exactly how you're going to handle hecklers. I remember I was in, you know, doing shows in Scotland where people get seriously drunk. And I, you know, I would be booked on a gig. If 8 o'clock, you'd be okay. By 9 p.m., they were just wasted. And then heckling you in a really thick, you know, Scottish brogue that's very hard to understand. And, right. you know, that was some of the hardest to deal with heckling I've ever experienced in my life because I just didn't know what to do with it.
Or what they're saying, right? Yeah.
Or even what they're saying. I mean, I think what it boiled down to was they were referring to various parts of my anatomy because, come on, they were essentially catcalling me on stage. You know, I think I've just learned to try and avoid the drunken shows. But it's interesting because, you know, when I was filming The Muslims Are Coming, we did a tour stop in Tucson, Arizona, and, you know, we generally didn't have Muslim audiences. You know, we assume that Muslims were on our side with trying to dispel Islamophobia. So most of the people we tried to kind of recruit to the shows and stuff like that were non-Muslims. But in this one tour stop, it was 500 people in the audience, and I'd say 20 or 30% of them were Muslim, which was really significant for us. And at some point, I started doing, you know, my material, which includes, like, stuff about dating and, you know, my genitals and whatnot. And at that point, a large group of Muslim women who were all, you know, covered in the job got up and left in a show of you know, they just didn't like my stand-up. And I had to kind of pretend like that wasn't happening in front of, you know, 470 other people. But it hurts, you know. It hurts when sometimes your own people don't come along for the ride. But I think it's getting better. And we're all still kind of like new immigrants. I'm first generation. So we're all still trying to figure out, like, what it means to kind of be Iranian, be American, bring the best of the East with the best of the West, and build a new utopia.
And each of us in our own little in our own little lane, it sucks when people in our lane give us a hard time. And they're not accepting. And, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. And do you get major backlash after shows are over? Like, how dare you? This is anti-Muslim. You're not following the faith. What are you doing?
Yeah, I would say that, like, conservative Muslims don't think, you know, aren't necessarily on board with what I'm doing, but also conservative Jews and conservative Christians. So I'm definitely an equal opportunity offender. Anyone who's conservative is not going to be happy with a lot of comedians in general, you know. Comedians can be risque, raunchy, you know, push the boundaries. So I definitely don't think... it's limited to Muslims not liking it.
And we live in this PC world now, but things are so un-PC, especially when you think about the character who's running for the Republican nomination for president. So PC seems to be in but out in big ways in different areas. So what was it like going through the Bible Belt? I mean, it must have been, I don't know, crazy.
It's interesting because what I really kind of like am thirsting for from people is to say this thing that I think that, you know, that they're afraid of saying. A lot of people are afraid of actually just talking about anything because they're afraid that, you know, they're going to come off as racist or culturally insensitive or whatever. And so the thing that they're thinking, which a lot of people are thinking, ends up getting swept under the rug, so we don't actually know what people feel like. And that's very dangerous because that means that the bigotry or the, you know, the confusion or the questions get, like, morphed into something bigger, morphed into fringe ideologies that lead to bigotry and violence, and that's no good for anyone. I think the bravest things that I've seen on the road are people that just are able to ask me, hey, like, what did you think of 9/11? I mean, people really ask me that. What do you think of 9/11?
Sure.
Now, I could get offended by that question. I could get, you know, my panties in a ruffle, or I could just say, you know what, this person's actually asking me a question that so many people actually want to ask me, but because they're afraid of some kind of, I don't know, backlash, they don't actually say the question. And I think it's more important for us to have the real conversations than to be offended all the time. And so, you know, I think that's bravery.
Okay, so let's ask the question. What do you think about 9/11?
I mean, I thought it was horrible. I thought it was horrific. And I was here in New York City, and I live in New York City. And, you know, and I was, you know, and I was a student, and it was scary. And I knew people that died. And so, you know, I was as upset and traumatized by it as any other American. And I think most Muslims are, but you just don't see very much reporting about like a bunch of reasonable people denouncing violence. You know, people don't know that Muslims denounce terrorism. People don't know that Muslims denounce 9/11. And then you have people like, you know, Donald Trump going on the campaign trail and saying that he heard thousands of people in New Jersey cheering. It's a lie. It's not corroborated by any kind of evidence, but people believe that. You say it enough times and people believe it.
And what about going to college campuses? I know that you talk about Cornell.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is that like?
You know, like, yeah, because, you know, there was a bit of a hubbub, I think, last year when Jerry Seinfeld said he wasn't going to do college campuses anymore
right.
because they were just too sensitive and they're too PC and he can't handle it. And I definitely feel like they are very PC. I do a lot of college campuses. And I just sort of, like, come out in the very beginning and say, like, a lot of the stuff I'm going to say might sound culturally insensitive, but there was no such thing as cultural sensitivity when I was growing up because it was a lot like today. So we need to just all calm down and just recognize that these are jokes. And when you sort of open up the dialogue that way as just, like, let's blanket disclaimer this as, like, I'm a comedian, okay? And everyone – and I, you know, because, like, I remember the first time I realized that – this PC-ness was kind of like missing the joke. I was doing a bit about how my mom, I say, you know, like she's a, you know, my parents are a touch, you know, they're immigrants. They're like, they could be a touch racist. Like my mom called me to say, you know, Negin, we have a new accountant. He is Indian, but that is okay because of his money. He is like a Jew. And so it's like this kind of double insult compliment.
Right,
I don't know what
right.
that is.
Yeah,
and
well,
I remember.
Yes.
After the show, like, someone came up, you know, a couple of people came up to me and they're like, we found that joke very anti-Semitic. And I was like, no, it's a commentary on the, what? No. Like, you missed the joke.
Calm down, right.
Joke.
Yeah, it went over your
Calm
head.
Calm down. So I think right now we're just really, like, we hear a word and just the mere mention of the word, we get our panties in a ruffle.
Right, the whole microaggression thing.
And that
it's like,
is frustrating,
stop.
And that does happen on college campuses.
Yeah. So have you tried the West Coast? I mean, I'm interested if you've appeared here in the Bay Area at Berkeley or at Stanford or any UC colleges.
The funny thing is, I think the last time I performed in Berkeley, it was for a fundraiser for a nonprofit. I can't even remember the name of the nonprofit. And my first question was like, will there be any children? They were like, no, absolutely not. And I show up and there was like 150 children and they're 200.
That's the worst.
You know, there's,
yeah.
And there's 300 parents running after them. It was like performing for a room of Amber Alerts. It was a total nightmare. So that was like my last experience in Berkeley. But I've had some really great shows in California. I'm like now like racking my brain for names of clubs and stuff that I've been at. But I've had some really great shows and I'm actually going to be in the Bay Area in Oakland on June 16th doing a book event at the First Memorial Church in Oakland. And
oh,
it'll
good.
Be me doing stand-up in a church defiling that church. So I think that is in it of itself a reason to come out. It'll be a really fun time.
Well, hopefully we can have you in studio.
How to make white people laugh.
Right. Yes, we'd love to have you in the studio. Come visit. By all means.
Oh, my God. That sounds wonderful.
Yes. Why do white people love conference?
So, yeah, in How to Make White People Laugh, I have a chapter called White People Love Conferences. And I've been to a lot of conferences, and my day I get hired a lot to do stand-up at conferences and whatnot, and I'm a TED Fellow, so I've been to the TED conferences. And it's just one of these things where you go and everyone gets their tote bag and they're so excited and it's all, it's just like, you know, bright white faces. And then they have that moment of like, you know, they have that moment of like cultural or sensitivity and diversity where they like, you know, I went to a conference once in Utah and they, and it was literally, it was like, you know, 45 white people and me, and then they had a Native American troop come and do like a spiritual song, blessing the land, you know, and it was like we all had this kumbaya moment over that, which was really lovely, but it was sort of like that doesn't mean you actually have done anything to protect the land yourself just because you listen to some Native Americans do it, you know, and so it always strikes me as funny. I think it gives us, you know, you go to these conferences and you have this like brief feeling of like, yeah, I'm gonna change the world. I'm a part of this conference and this movement. And then, you know, by the time it's Monday, you're back, you know, at your cubicle and you're like planning your Netflix queue.
I love Negan Farsad's book, How to Make White People Laugh. On the cover, there you are, and it looks like you have a PowerPoint presentation, which would be very white. And except it makes, when I walk into a meeting and I see PowerPoint, it makes my head want to explode. It really does. I have to tell
you. White people love PowerPoint.
Yes, they do love PowerPoint way too much. All right, let's take a break and we'll be back with Negin Farsad, How to Make White People Laugh on the Drex Radio Show on KGO.
This is the Drex Radio Show on KGO 810.
Well, God bless those people at Ace Hardware. They put the grill together for you. Can you come over and assemble my my portable air conditioner? That's just duct tape to hell. It's just one duct tape mess. Yes, I made a mistake on Amazon. Surprise. Negin, I do bad things on the weekends with Amazon. Don't shop and drink.
Oh.
Oh, what can I tell you? What can I tell you?
I don't really drink, so I just do stupid things sober.
Well, I don't really drink that much. I'm just back to the wine. I had surgery last year, but anyway, but that's beyond. I want to say this. Everybody, it's Negin Farsad, but it's, if you want to go to her website, it's Negin, N-E-G-I-N, so you can remember that, Negin, and then Farsad, F-A-R-S-A-D. That's also her Twitter handle. And thank you very much for joining me. The name of her book is How to Make White People Laugh, and she is an Iranian, Islamic, American. And I wanted to ask you, because we were discussing politics, and you talked about Mitt Romney, who keeps trying to mess everything up for Donald Trump, whether he succeeds, well, he's not going to, we know that. But what were you doing about his campaign in 2012?
I actually, in 2012, with another comedian, Lee Camp, we went to the Cayman Islands to look for Mitt Romney's offshore bank account.
I love it.
To look for his hidden money. And so, you know, and we went all over the island, like, asking people, like, where does he keep his money and all that stuff. And they are very, very serious about security there. There's millions and millions and millions of dollars in the Cayman Islands that's being hidden by, all of America's billionaires and Europe's billionaires and millionaires. And we actually would walk into these banks and not to brag, but at the end of every month, I have something like $5 to $15 in disposable income. So what we would do is walk into these banks and be like, hi, I want to open an offshore bank account with $8.27. Here's my bag of change. And of course, you know, they would call security on us. And, you know, we were close to being arrested multiple times just investigating offshore banks. But escaped, got out of Cayman Islands, without getting arrested. But yeah, that's the kind of thing. Again, that's the kind of thing I feel like social justice comedy is really good for. You take an issue like banking. It sounds boring. Who wants to talk about finance? Like, to be honest, I don't ever want to talk about it. But it's so important. It matters so much in our day-to-day lives, like how these banks handle money.
Oh,
and
sure.
Like how much money is hidden from the American taxpayers and all
this is burning. Bernie's whole thing, yes.
Exactly. And so all this stuff is so important. And I think comedy can do a really good job of making it a little bit more digestible, a little bit easier to swallow.
And isn't it crazy? I mean, you were looking for Romney's money, and we still don't know what's up with Trump's money because he will not release his tax documents. And people say Mitt Romney, of all people, says that's because there's a bombshell in there. I mean, it's quite ironic. You know, the irony in all of that is
absolutely
insane. Yeah.
I mean, I think the bombshell is that essentially he's not as rich as he says.
I think
he is.
So too.
And,
yes.
You know, he's had so many failing businesses, and I feel like, you know, we began to scratch the surface on his failing businesses, but they're not nearly as big a story as I feel like they should be. But this guy, like, he's tried everything, you know, from building a fake, you know, basically fake university to stakes, and he's failed at all of it. The Trump brand is actually a failing brand. So this is something I feel like all his fans who think he's so smart, like, really need to look at.
Well, let's hope he surrounds himself with the right people if he becomes the president. I want to ask you, because bootleg Islam, because you have a chapter in your book called that. Yes, what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, the chapter is basically, in one of the ways that I believe in making how to make white people laugh, is kind of telling people your own story, sort of coming out of the closet about your own background. A lot of us minorities out there maybe try and hide aspects of our own identity because we just want to fit in, so we don't really like bother telling people about our things, our traditions, our customs. And I think one of the best ways you can actually normalize relations is and give good PR for your people and make white people laugh is actually tell them the funny, frustrating, ridiculous stories about your family life and what it's like to be from your country. And Bootleg Islam, I talk about going to Iran. And actually on that trip, I went to Iran and I managed to smuggle in a bunch of Jay-Z CDs and some copies of Vogue and Cosmopolitan. Okay, that's how.
Naughty girl. Good it wasn't a Kardashian.
Contraband.
Yes, especially after the story I told you about, they think that she Kardashian's a spy. Yes.
Exactly. This stuff is prohibited in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so I felt very cool that I managed to smuggle it in. And the minute I arrived in the airport in Tehran, there was an earthquake that was really big. It was like it registered like 7.0 on the Richter scale or something. And the lights went out and everyone was frantically running and everything smelled like enriched uranium. And it did not smell like enriched uranium. But it smelled like bacon. And I was running around. It was commotion, and that was like my welcome to Iran. There's a huge earthquake.
That's because you brought in that contraband. Naughty girl.
Jay-Z has that power.
That was Allah coming after you. All right, we're going to leave it at that. Thank you very much, Nagin Farsad. And when are you coming to Berkeley again?
I'm going to be in Oakland June 16th.
Do you know where you're appearing?
At the First Memorial Church. First Congregational Church?
Oh, okay.
First Congregational Church.
So you're going to do your comedy? Is it a church? You're going to do your comedy bit at a church?
Yeah, and they have live events there. And
I love it.
It'll be fun and great. I'll be doing stand-up in a church. The weirder thing is, it's not my first time doing stand-up in a church.
That's great.
So,
I love it.
So it'll be fun. I'll have copies of the book, and I'll be signing and all that stuff.
And we'll have you in here in the studio. All right, Nagin, thank you very much. And I know it's midnight in the Apple, so get some rest and enjoy your holiday weekend.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thank you. And we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with the Late Night Late Show wrap-up on the Drex Radio Show on KGO 810.